Yeah, man, it's the show. Welcome back to it. Hope y'all had a good weekend. I hope the job you're at now doesn't suck too bad. Try to help you out a little bit here. Yeah, it's my show. Did I say my name? I'm Scott Horton. Yes, my short-term memory is that bad. My long-term memory is awesome. Short-term? I don't remember what I was talking about anymore. What was it? Oh, yeah. How bad my memory is. It's pretty bad. Don't remember how many times I've said it now. I think this will be the third now. Scott Horton. But I'll tell you what, I'll fix it up with a .org at the end. That's my website. ScottHorton.org. And you can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,500 of them now going back to 2003. And you find all my whole show, not all, but many, many years worth, anyway, of whole show archives there as well. And you can find my blog and all the articles I ever wrote and a bookstore of a bunch of reading you ought to do. And there's a page of fair use articles that I want to save for safekeeping that, you know, like a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm, which is no longer online at its original source. Stuff like that. I got documentaries, all of which were made by somebody else, but just that I've collected there that good for watching and whatever, you know, I don't know. Troll around. ScottHorton.org. Oh, and by the way, would you click on the links on the right side of the page there to my sponsors and support what they are doing? The Council for the National Interest, the Future Freedom Foundation. Yeah, they mostly need donations. FFF could use your subscription to the Future Freedom, their monthly journal edited by Sheldon Richmond. How about that? Council for the National Interest, of course, Phil Giraldi's group, the anti-Israel lobby, the America lobby in Washington, D.C., and then, you know, there's all kind of other sponsors there. There's books for reading, and there's bitcoins for buying and whatever, you know, gold. Click on all that stuff, man. Support my sponsors. Help support this show. Darren's Coffee is there if you like drinking caffeine in the morning like me. My God, am I worthless without coffee. Ain't much better with it, but without it, forget about it at all. I just... Anyway, darrenscoffee.com. Support the sponsors, check out the website. Also, you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. And yes, I'm pretty cranky a lot of the time, and I really hate the government a lot, and especially the military and the cops, and the politicians, and everyone who works at every agency. And everyone who thinks that they're legitimate in their supposed authority. And everyone who disagrees with me about anything at all. So yeah, I'm tweeting a lot of cranky crap over there at / Scott Horton Show. It's just like the radio show, only when the show's over, I go back to tweeting out little things at a time. All right, well, Thomas Harrington is going to be back on the show today, and I think I want to talk Israel-Palestine with him because, well, he's written this book, Living La Vida Baroka. You can find it in the right margin there at scotthorton.org. It's about America in this day and age of empire. It's really good, man. I think you'll like it. And it has a very interesting perspective there because he spent so much time in Spain and studied it and is a professor of Spanish history and all this stuff. So that's kind of a unique spin on analyzing the American empire, for what it's worth, I think. And he writes quite a bit about Israel-Palestine and, of course, American responsibility for what's going on in Israel and Palestine in the book. So I plan on asking him all about that today. And, pardon me. And Landay's going to be here. And you know how Landay is. He likes talking even more than me. So I think I just got the two questions for him. And that'll be enough. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about in the war. And that excludes all the stuff that I'm saving to talk about with Mitchell Prothero tomorrow. Did you see Mitchell Prothero's new piece? French intelligence agent defects to Al-Qaeda. Was a major target of the initial strikes on Syria last week, 2 weeks ago. Boy, I need my war this time around timeline. I need to go back and write it all down. When was what? But anyway, French intelligence agent. Nobody knows whether he was a double agent all along or what. But apparently has defected to Al-Qaeda. And go read what Prothero wrote and the way he wrote it. He's got multiple sources all over the place. huge scoop by our friend Mitchell Prothero, writing from Iraq there for McClatchyDC.com. And we'll not be discussing that with Landay today. That's Prothero's scoop. This one belongs to both of them, though. And so we are going to be talking about this with Jonathan Landay. In fact, I better make sure that Garris has this. Does Garris have this? Boots in the air. U.S. helicopters return to combat in Iraq for the first time. United States sent attack helicopters into combat against Islamic State targets west of Baghdad on Sunday, the first time low-flying army aircraft have been committed to fighting in an engagement that the Obama administration promised would not include boots on the ground. The U.S. Central Command, in a statement about U.S. activities against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, provided few specifics about the helicopters, but they were likely AH-64 Apache attack helicopters, which were deployed to Baghdad International Airport in June to provide protection for U.S. military and diplomatic facilities. Until Sunday, U.S. airstrikes in Iraq have been limited to fast-moving Air Force and Navy fighter aircraft and drones, but the use of the relatively slow-flying helicopters represents an escalation of American military involvement and is a sign that the security situation in Iraq's Anbar province is deteriorating. Last week, the Islamic State militants overran numerous Iraqi bases and towns and were becoming a widespread presence in Abu Ghraib, the last major town, outside Baghdad's western suburbs. Jeffrey White, this is the guy the other day who was saying, yeah, but I like al-Nusra even though they're al-Qaeda because they're fighting against Hezbollah. Remember him? Same guy. Former senior DIA analyst who closely follows development in Iraq said the use of helicopter gunships by the U.S. means that U.S. troops effectively are now directly involved in ground battles. Quote, it's definitely boots in the air. This is combat, assuming U.S. Army guys were flying the helicopters, said White, a defense fellow at WINEP, a center-right policy institute. That's one way of putting it. Using helicopter gunships in combat operations means those forces are in combat. Moreover, the Obama administration's decision to authorize the use of U.S. helicopter gunships indicates that nearly 2 months of U.S.-led airstrikes by fixed-wing fighters and bombers have failed to stop the Islamic State from massing ground troops and launching offensive operations, he said. It means, however, we were applying air power previously didn't work to stop them from putting together offensive actions. One of the hopes was that using air power would impede them from using offensive operations, White said, but apparently they have been successful in doing that despite the airstrikes. Yeah, as has been obvious this whole time. The airstrikes are nothing but Obama basically serving Baghdadi's PR department. That's it. They had to change from convoys of Toyota trucks to sneaking around a little more carefully. Oh, yeah, but it hasn't put them back at all. They just changed their tactics a little bit, and they're fine. Oh, you mean we can't all drive in a giant column of Toyota trucks down the highway because we'll get strafed? Okay, well, we'll just go a few at a time in different directions and then double back. Or I don't know. We'll hitchhike. All right, well, so that's coming up. Here's our Prothero for tomorrow. This one is, Gutman, that's not the one I'm looking for. What the hell? McClatchy's paywall is pissing me off. Oh, here we go. This is it. The U.S., this is what I want to talk to Landay about more than anything. U.S., oh, we talked about this last week on the show. I think I read most of this article out loud on the show. I was having so much fun. U.S. anti-Assad rebels in Syria remain at odds over the role of al-Qaeda's Nusra Front. Yeah, this is the one with Jeffrey White saying, yeah, but so what if they're al-Qaeda? They're against Iranian interests, and so we like them, because he's speaking for Israel first. Anyway, that's all coming up on the show. More coverage of Iraq War 3. Well, it includes Syria now, too. The war against the Islamic State, whatever you want to call it. And worse, coming up on the show. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. So it's the fall of Kobani, I guess. That's how you say it. There in northern Syria, right at the Turkish border. In Syrian Kurdistan. And the Turks are just sitting there letting it happen. I was just reading some tweets from a lady tweeting inside from there. In fact, I had a tab open to the guy that she was with, too. They're both tweeting out this reporter. These two reporters talking about the fall of Kobani right in front of their eyes and how they were getting shot at up on the rooftop where they were reporting and taking pictures of the ISIS guys and saying that the Turkish tanks are all lined up on the Turkish side of the hill, Turkish side of the line, but they're just sitting there. They're not doing a damn thing. And I guess they made the call that they don't mind all the civilian refugees. They would rather have all these civilian refugees come pouring into Turkey, Kurdish refugees, come pouring into Turkey than support their defense forces in their fight against ISIS. This unmitigated evil, this existential threat to all things that are good and true and peaceful on the planet Earth, supposedly. And they're pretty bad guys. But the Turks, just like before, still, their policy is, go ahead and kill the PKK, see if we care. What are they going to do, side with the PKK after all this time? And anyway... So here's the thing about it. I mean, this is just one. The real point, I'll go ahead and make the real point now because I'll probably forget to make it or run out of time to make it by the end of the damn segment. The real point is this is what a ridiculous and complicated mess this war is, and this is just one tiny little taste of it. And there are 100 of these conflicts of interest that go around and around and around in circles over there in the Middle East right now. Here, ISIS is marching on the Kurds. You know, the Kurds that in Iraq are our friends, that we're backing against ISIS, right? The PKK communists, who they're not the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga, but they're more based in Turkey, but somewhat in Iraq, too. They were the ones who helped the Yazidis escape. There were some Yazidis that needed escaping. It was just the 400,000 and the giant genocide and all that was a myth. But it wasn't the Americans that saved them anyway. It was the PKK that came in and saved the Yazidis. These are our good guys, right? Except that they're the avowed enemies of the Turks. Bill Clinton paid the Turks to kill Kurds for 8 years straight. There's a massive war there. And their leader is in jail but is in the process of negotiating with the Turkish government. So the war has been on ceasefire. But so when it comes down to the Islamic State of Iraq, the butchers, the Khmer Rouge-style nihilists of Omar Baku al-Baghdadi versus the PKK communists, which are, you know, the Turkish Kurdish rebels, and their kin on the Syrian side of the line, Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, our NATO ally, just like all along, would rather sit back and let them get killed. He's not going to do a thing. And their parliament voted just the other day to give him the authority. He's still not doing a thing. And where's Obama on all this? Obama's bombing everybody except, or I guess maybe they did actually hit some targets outside of Kobane, but way too little too late this whole time. I'm not encouraging them to strike anything, but I'm just saying, compared to their claimed policy that, yeah, we're at war against the Islamic State now in Iraq and in Syria. Well, here they are marching on the Kurds, about to take this town of, I don't know how many people live in the city of, or anymore after all the refugees have fled or what, but this is a city that they're taking, I think, not just a town. It's kind of a, I don't know exactly what's the line there. But, anyway, that just goes to show you what an absolute mess this war is, with conflicts of interest in so many different places. And check out the spotlight today on antiwar.com by David Stockman. You know, let me say this about David Stockman real quick. Here's a guy who was Ronald Reagan's budget director, and I learned from the Tom Woods interview of him that he always was anti-war. He was, as a conservative, he was a fiscal conservative. He was never a war hawk, and I don't think he was ever like a moral majority type. He was perhaps a supply side or Chicago school type. I'm not sure. But he certainly seems like an Austrian school, real free market type now, as opposed to the Chicago school conservatives. And he is just so good on so many things. It's just, man, it's really something else. It's like this brand new, gigantic contribution to the libertarian movement. You know, he's like Doug Bandow or one of these guys who really knows so much about everything and is really good on everything, too. You know, we don't have to only go to liberals to cover foreign policy. Here's a guy who, show him a Middle Eastern conflict and he will break it down. And this one right now, it's a spotlight on antiwar.com today. It's at David Stockman's ContraCorner.com. The Siege of Kobani, whatever it is. Obama's Syrian fiasco in motion. And I forget now how it ends, but it certainly starts out with the same conflict of interest that I'm just talking about here. And you can really read about it and understand. He's got a map of Kurdistan, which is, of course, divided into five major pieces. Four major pieces plus Armenia. And anyway, he's got all this context about the PKK war with the Turks and everything that's going on here. And I'm trying to figure out if I should try to pick the most talking pointy part of it, or whatever, the soundbite part. The U.S. is making perfunctory airstrikes, yet with no boots on the ground, in the context of a close urban combat in a city of 50,000 people. There's the answer to that question I was asking rhetorically a second ago. A major onslaught would result in massive civilian casualties. Although Obama has already much blood on his hands, he is apparently not ready for a Gaza on the Euphrates. So then why doesn't Turkey put some infantry and spotters on the ground? Highly trained boots that are literally positioned a few kilometers away on its side of the border. Well, Turkish President Erdogan just explained his government's reluctance quite succinctly, as reported by Bloomberg on Saturday. And that's not Bloomberg, the former mayor, that's Bloomberg, the news service. On Saturday, quote, this is Erdogan talking, quote, "For us, the Islamic State and the PKK are the same." And then Stockman continues, and that's literally true, because from Turkey's vantage point, the Kobani showdown is a case of terrorist on terrorist. The Kurdish fighters in Kobani are linked to the Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK. The latter has waged a separatist campaign of et cetera, et cetera. So there you go. It'd be like asking Israel to back Hezbollah against Al-Qaeda. Not going to happen, man. And so, just one small part of this mess. And then I'm trying to, you know what, let me page through here, because I think he explains, too, about how this is why, well, I guess that is the explanation. If Obama was going to have any boots there to point laser pointers at targets, they would need to be Kurdish ones. He's too afraid to put special forces of, you know, American special forces in Syria now. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. All right, so one of my newest sponsors, as you know, is Thomas Harrington, author of the book Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies. If you go to scotthorton.org/books or in fact, if you just go to scotthorton.org, you'll see it right there on the right side of the page, and a hot link to Amazon where you can buy it. And very happy to welcome Thomas back to the show. How are you doing?
Great. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing real good. So, listen, I was explaining to the people at the top of the show here about how you really cover a lot of different subjects in the essays in this great book, and all the perspective of incorporating Spanish history and a perspective from Spain on the American Empire, and all that's great. But one of the other things that's really great about this book is there are quite a few really good essays about the situation in Israel and Palestine and the American role, of course, in making it what it is. And so I guess to start off, I was reading a thing. I'm not certain. I'm fairly certain this was a quote from Netanyahu's UN speech, actually, but I didn't see it. I was reading it, so I might be confused on the exact origin. But it was very recently where he was saying, oh, yeah, no, we're going to make peace with the Palestinians at some point and let them have their second state at some point. I'm very roughly paraphrasing here. But he said, but it's not because, you know, they have the right to any of this land or anything. All of, he's certainly talking about the West Bank, all that is Israel. It belongs to us, but we're considering, you know, maybe letting them have some of it if it'll shut them up for a while, kind of a attitude. And I was just thinking that, I guess I was a little bit surprised that they're that frank about it, when I thought the policy was to pretend that someday they're actually going to work this out. Whereas, you know, right there, that's basically an admission that the Palestinians can just go to hell. The Likud, the right-wing nationalist parties and coalition in power there in Israel, they're just not ever going to let the people of Palestine have independence ever. Is that the way you read that too?
I do read it, and I think what's interesting is in the last few years we've seen a gradual increase in the frankness about this. I don't know if you saw that Richard Cohen's book has come out for the Washington Post, and he's quite frank about the idea that there was ethnic cleansing, apparently. I haven't read it all fully. I've seen parts of it. And that this was necessary to do. It's also a position that is held by Benny Morris, one of the new Israeli historians, who was one of the people that first talked about what had not been talked about. That was the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And he's finally come around to the position of, yep, we had to do it. It needed to be done. And so I think there's an increasing idea that we're not going to keep up the pretenses any longer, that the world is about force, we have the force, and it's really a matter of exercising that. After all, they have the unquestioned support of the United States. And I take it even further. When you're on a college campus, you begin to see these in terms of the idea battles on campus, and there is a greater and greater clarity about the fact that the idea is to simply not allow other points of view on campus, at least ones that go outside the officially prescribed parameters of the discourse. So, yeah, I think the idea of having to keep up the pretext is going away, and they're just saying, "Yep, this is what we're going to do because we have to do it."
Yeah. Well, except here's the thing, though. Even people like Corporal Goldberg over the Atlantic say this is stupid and suicidal. You know, I mean, and I'm talking about people who are Zionists or, you know, nationalists, you know, right-wing Zionists who are saying, hey, listen, the priority is keeping a Jewish supermajority and keeping a democracy. And we can't do that if we, you know, outright or at least de facto own the West Bank so bad that it might as well, where everybody accepts it as de jure. It's no longer occupied territory. It has been annexed at some point here, even if they don't call it that. Maybe we're already way past that point now, but it's, in other words, it's coming to the point of view where the perception is that this isn't occupied territory. It's just part of Israel. And then that way it's right around 50-50. Maybe the Jews are actually even in a minority now. If we're going to count all the Palestinians, as the Leverets pointed out recently, count all the Palestinians in the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as all the Christian and Arab Israeli citizens, they're actually the majority now already making it. And then the theory goes, I mean, I don't know, how long it's supposed to take, but that at some point is not tenable. When the place may be Jim Crow and everything, but when the oppressed are the outright majority, at that point, then it becomes a situation where just for political correctness reasons or whatever, like South Africa, it has to come apart because the rest of the world just won't accept it. So, I mean, is Jeffrey Goldberg wrong to worry?
That's an important question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Is Jeffrey Goldberg wrong to worry? I mean, is the answer
no,
to this no?
Of course he's right to be worried. But, of course, his worry is misplaced in the sense that the thing he should be worried about is the original architecture of a state that wants to be Jewish. I mean, we've heard it so many times over the years that Israel is a Jewish and democratic state. Israel is a Jewish and democratic state. That we often don't stop and ask ourselves what those words mean. And when we begin to deconstruct what it means, it's an absurdity. How can you be democratic when you have one group that has inscribed in the laws of the state advantages that other people don't have? You know, I work on Spanish nationalism, and there was a strain of Basque nationalism that used to talk about blood types and how if we're going to have a real Basque nation, we need to have people with this certain blood type, which was prominent among Basques, and we need to have purity of Basque names as one of the markers of what we're going to do in the nation. Well, rightly, that was laughed out of left field. That was seen as completely inappropriate for anyone in a country that seeks to be democratic to be talking in that way. And that went by the boards. You know, the last people talking that way went by the boards in the 80s. But that's, in effect, what we have in Israel. We have an entrenched set of privileges to a group of people possessing, call it a cultural or even biological markers in some ways. I'm reading a great book that, in fact, I'd even encourage you to have the author on. Her name is Ofra Lith Yeshua, or Yeshua Lith. It's The Case for a Secular New Jerusalem. And she's the daughter, actually granddaughter, of Israeli pioneer settlers. And she came to the agreement, to the realization over the years, very painfully, that it was the underlying architecture that privileged one group of people over the other that makes the whole thing untenable. So, yeah, Jeffrey Goldberg should be worried. But the flaw is in the design and not in the fact that mm-hmm. other people are there. I mean, this was inevitable in one way or another.
Right. Well, no, I mean, and that makes sense to me, and I encourage everybody. Max Blumenthal is going to be on the show later in the week. I encourage people to go watch his speech at the kind of makeshift tribunal, their war crimes tribunal that they had, the Russell Tribunal, it's called, where he closes by saying, you got to understand this is part and parcel of Zionism. You know, you can't have Zionism without this mess, and that's why we have this mess. And so, you know, you got to understand it in that context. And yet, and I don't have a dog in the fight, you know, I really don't care other than it's the U.S. government's fault overall, which is what I care about. But it seems to me like if the Israelis were trying to be cool, then they could have peace. They could have withdrawn from the occupied territories in 1969 and said, okay, guys, you can have your independent state, but we're going to have, you know, whatever. They could have done it in 88 after Arafat recognized them, or they could have done it after the leaders of Hamas had promised to recognize. Ah, hell, and now we got to go out to this break, Thomas. But so this is the question on the other side of the break. Couldn't they, if Rabin hadn't been shot, couldn't they have worked this out somehow? That kind of overall question versus the premise that Zionism itself just mandates this sort of outcome. One moment, we'll be right back with Thomas Harrington, author of Livin' La Vida Baroka, professor at Trinity College. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, guys, welcome back. Gals, too. All y'all. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Thomas Harrington. He's the author of this great book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies. And there's sort of a pseudo-conflict of interest, because, yeah, he's advertising on the show. Isn't that great? But I love the book, and I'm happy to tell you about it anyway. I'd have him on to interview about it anyway. So it's all good. I'll take your bribe anyway, Thomas.
I like your transparency, Scott, but yeah, I like your show.
Yeah, anything but the whole truth is a damn lie, if you ask me, so I got to say. All right, now, so listen, here's what my question is that if Rabin hadn't been shot and, say, he had somehow negotiated away control over East Jerusalem and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and had, you know, tried to have a good faith effort at working with the Palestinian Authority to set up the kind of government that they could live peacefully next door to, et cetera, whatever, in a reasonable way, not in a Likudnik kind of a Ariel Sharon sort of way. Could that have ever worked? I mean, I guess maybe the fact he got a bullet in the head from a right-wing settler Zionist kook is sort of proof, you know, kind of undoes the argument itself. But it just seemed to me always like the right-wing nationalists there are putting the nation in a position that is untenable unnecessarily, and that in fact if they would just give the Palestinians independence, then as cruel as it is, unenlightened as it is to have the 80-20 Jewish democracy and all of that that they have, it's still better than occupation forever. And so maybe at least it would last a little longer. I don't know.
I think it's interesting because it gets into the history of Zionism, which I'm not an academic expert, but there's a divided core in Zionism. The revisionist Zionism, which came of age, so to speak, with Begin, really had a vision of the whole land of Palestine and that there was a need to have it. The labor side of things, the liberal Zionists, if you will, that were predominant for the first 20 years or maybe 30 years of Israel's history, that's a more ambiguous question, and that's where I remit to experts greater than mine, but there seems to be two schools of thought on that. Were these people ever interested in coexistence, or were they just interested in a sort of much more polite way of maintaining Jewish majorities and Jewish control over the land? I think what is what we do know, though, is that after the assassination of Rabin, the right has generally just taken on more and more pieces of the terrain of power in Italy, in Israel, and such that there seems to be very little left. Even the two-state solution at this point seems to be, something that has very little relevance any longer. As I say, there's the Arab League plan out there, which no one seems to even talk about. That would seem to, if peace really were the object, that would seem to be a place to start. But that doesn't even get mentioned. It doesn't even get responded to by the Israeli government.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, from their spin, anything proposed by Arab anything would be completely ridiculous and illegitimate and a non-starter, no matter what. It would have to come from them in the first place. And, geez, they just can't find anyone to negotiate with. There's no
but
partner.
The dynamic is to me, what is depressing is there seems to be no obvious end game. Once you dehumanize mentally and rhetorically and culturally people with whom you're trying to work out a problem, you really destroy the ability to do so. And you can see this same mentality spreading in the United States. I think one of the most depressing things I've seen in the course of my lifetime is the idea that you have enemies, but enemies should be talked to. Now we have enemies that are unspeakable, that are evil, that are beyond the pale, and therefore we can't even begin to talk with them. This wasn't always the case. I mean, we had a nuclear-armed Soviet Union that we talked to, we made sense out of, or at least we tried. We didn't give up being what we were, but we tried to understand them. And this sort of cultural autism, as they call it, seems to be spreading everywhere, and that's very frightening to me. And it seems to have one of its prime points of emphasis there in Israel-Palestine.
Yeah,
we have to make these people evil. And instead of saying, we're all evil, everyone is part evil, part good, we have different points of view, but let's work it out. In fact, you even see it on the left-right divide in this country. trying to get some people from the left to listen to your program or to listen to read antiwar.com is a lot of work. Those are those people, and I don't need to read them. When in fact, there's a lot in common when you start talking about it and start seeing, putting ideas down side by side.
Yeah, especially when it's the left-wing slogan that it's the 99% versus the 1%. Well, this country's not 1% right-wing and or libertarian, right? So, but I agree with them about the 99% thing. In fact, I'd be more specific. I'd say it's more like 99.9. And, you know, that kind of thing. But, so yeah, I mean, I always try to be very ecumenical. Most of my guests are liberals, obviously, because liberals are the only ones who are good on foreign policy for the most part and really write about it, other than David Stockman and Doug Bandow and a few others. Mostly you got to look to the left if you want expertise on this stuff, because people on the right and even, you know, libertarians just don't seem to care all that much, most of them. Anyway.
I don't know. I find there's a lot of good libertarian voices, too, that have made me look at the history of American foreign policy in very different ways. For example, the idea that I have come across through you guys, if you will, Woodrow Wilson's role in creating many of the problems of the American empire. Franklin Roosevelt, you look at him with a different, through a different focus. That doesn't mean I take away everything that's admirable about him, but it's made me rethink how we've really acted over time. And I think it's very healthy to do that without losing some of the core convictions that you have.
Right. And it's just a matter of priorities. I mean, I still believe, and maybe this is silly, but I still believe that maybe even a supermajority of Americans really do want to be free and would even tolerate their neighbors being free, too, if that was the price they had to pay. If only they had, you know, they had it put before them in such a way where they could choose it. You know what I mean?
I think you're raising an interesting point, and one that interests me a lot. And I really wonder whether we educate for freedom in this country anymore. And I think there's a theorist of education, Henry Giroux, who's also a cultural critic, who's quite excellent, who talks again and again about how we have internalized authoritarian ways of looking at the world over the last several decades, and that the neoliberal model has made us commodify people, and that parents now educate their children in order to make them cogs in the machine, and accepting the idea that there's always someone more powerful that you'll have to pay fealty to. That wasn't a way I was raised, and I dare say a lot of people growing up in the 70s and 80s, as I did, were not always thinking about, hey, who's the strong man that I have to please? And now I see a lot of Americans basically assume that there's always some concentrated power that you have to suck up to in a certain way. And so it gets into interesting questions about, can you educate for freedom? And I think, frankly, the left has fallen down on that, and I think the right has fallen down on it in the sense that both have their centers of power that they want respected before anything, and then there can be freedom around the margins.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, like you were mentioning with campus speech earlier, wherever there's a possibility for factions to clamp down on each other, like on campuses, boy, they'll do it. And there doesn't seem to be any restraint whatsoever. It's not just Israel and Palestine, but there's 10,000 speech codes across this country right now.
And one of the most fascinating things is that I was in graduate school back when the whole PC began as a left-wing phenomenon, and I objected to it then, and there weren't a lot of people on the left objecting to it. And now what's fascinating is it's crossed the political spectrum, and it's now the right that is taking advantage of the ability to silence people through good taste or offensiveness, and they're taking it to a whole new level. So we have taboo subjects on the left, taboo subjects on the right, and we have young people avid to learn who nonetheless have been socialized in this idea that there's always someone you have to worry about offending. When in fact, if you really look at education, it should be about opening the mind, if anything, erring on the edge, on the side of being free.
Yeah.
And it really troubles me that we seem to not have that idea any longer.
All right. Well, we're working on it. I appreciate your time on the show again, Thomas.
Okay, Scott, thanks a lot.
Been very good. That's Thomas Harrington, everybody. He's a professor at Trinity College, and he's the author of Living La Vida Baroca, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxy. He's finding the margin there at scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Living La Vida Baroca, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Living La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm doing too many things at once. I'm trying to do a live radio show. Hey, listen to Joe Biden. He's apologizing now. Chat room, dude, I'll get back to you in a minute at the break. Joe Biden. So he's apologizing now because he told the truth. You know how Joe Biden is. He's a complete kook. And sometimes he accidentally tells the truth to everybody when he ain't supposed to. Oftentimes he lies, too. But in this case, he got too comfortable speaking before the crowd at Harvard and started blaming all of America's allies in the Middle East for the rise of ISIS. Now, what's funny about that is that you already know that, but you also know that these countries that he's naming, they're not just allies of America, they are satellite states of America. And Saudi and Qatar and Turkey, for three, have been working on supporting the rebellion in Syria, yes, including al-Nusra, and at least by one degree of separation, ISIS too, maybe more directly than that in some ways, since they split off back last year from the al-Nusra front. This has been a CIA operation all along. This has been an American operation all along. Remember, Obama said Assad must go. And up until the fall of Mosul in June, the entire narrative was still that who cares about al-Nusra suicide bombers or ISIS prisoner crucifiers? The bad guy in Syria is Assad. The guy with the clean-shaven chin who's protecting the coalition of minorities that these Islamists would exterminate. You already knew that. You already know that when he accuses Turkey, he's got four fingers pointed back at him. But anyway, it's nice to hear a little bit of honesty in this audio from the Vice President of the United States. And by the way, if you Google Biden at Harvard, you know what you'll find? He apparently said to the Vice President of Harvard, "Oh, you're Vice President too, ain't that a bitch?" And you're supposed to be completely scandalized that, I guess, one, he used the B word. Oh, my goodness, really, the B word. And then, two, that he implied that being the vice president isn't the greatest thing in the world. A warm bucket of spit. Was it worse? I forgot what was the original. Was it Vice President Taft who said that back before he was the president? Anyway. That's supposedly the big headline out of Biden's Harvard speech, the B word. Anyway, sorry. Here's the news.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria.
For the first time, U.S. authorities openly admit their allies in the Middle East have been aiding terrorists.
The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
But it wasn't that long ago that American officials seemed so confident, both in the Syrian opposition.
I just don't agree that a majority are al-Qaeda and the bad guys. That's not true.
Our intelligence agencies, I think, have a very good handle on who to
Never mind this idiot, but wait, here comes.
And also stood shoulder to shoulder with their allies aiding them in Syria.
We are working hand in glove with the Turks, with the Jordanians, with the Saudis, and with all the people in the region, attempting to identify the people who deserve the help.
So there you go. I'm sorry. I meant to record all the operative parts of that separately, but that's me plagiarizing from RT there. They had the clip. You can find it at RT.com. Biden blames U.S. allies in Middle East. Seriously, go to Google Video or YouTube and search for Biden at Harvard, and almost everything that comes up is about the B word, about being a vice president, and not about this most scandalous issue on the face of the planet, the highest treason of the Obama administration on behalf of the Mujahideen in Libya, too, but certainly in Syria the last 3 years. And now Biden, ANCAP man in the chat room says, well, it seemed like it was quite deliberate to me. Yeah, that's really right. I think I probably set that up wrong. I think, you know, it's him trying to say, okay, it is true that all our allies did it, but we tried to tell him not to, which everybody already knows is a lie. I mean, come on, man. This has been on the front page of, and I could cite a lot better sources, but I couldn't cite more official sources for you than the New York Times and the Washington Post, who have reported repeatedly for years that, and hell, throw in the LA Times too, that's just about as official, right? But especially New York Times and Washington Post, they've admitted for years that all of America's efforts to coordinate the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Jordanians, and the financing, arming, and training of the Mujahideen has benefited the very worst of them. The moderates mostly are just big fat expats hanging back at the hotel on the CIA payroll. Hillary tried to create these moderate coalition governments who all immediately, and in fact, this is in Lande's piece we're going to talk with him about later, they all immediately denounced the U.S. and endorsed the al-Nusra Front. It was the only chance, I've been saying this for years too, you know I have, it was the only chance they have at legitimacy at all is to support the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. It's the Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, basically. They came home to Syria, and then Obama and Hillary and Petraeus and Panetta and Biden and Kerry and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, has helped support them. Now, I think that they probably backed off that support about a year ago. Once ISIS split off from Nusra, the Americans backed off a lot. But then again, the Turks haven't. And I know that Obama is probably the biggest B word in the whole country. Wow, did I make the news now? He's the biggest B word ever to be the president of the United States. But are you telling me that if he called the king of Saudi Arabia and started yelling at him or yelling at Prince Bandar, whoever on the phone, that, hey, I'm serious right now, stop it, that they wouldn't have to stop it? Are you kidding me? This has been an American operation from the beginning. I told you a million times. Phil Giraldi broke the story. And we already knew it in 2011. It was already going on in 2011 for months. But what Giraldi broke the story of was there's a brand new finding. An official order from the president to the CIA to go after Assad and the Iranians too. That's in December 2011. Washington Secret Wars at antiwar.com and NATO versus Syria at the American Conservative Magazine. Read them up. And there were already reports from our friend Eric Margulies about French special forces helping lead the Mujahideen there and working with the Saudis. There was already a report in The Guardian in the summer of 2011 about how Prince Bandar is training up the Mujahideen. And, you know, I think it was Prothero that said that the Saudi money was mostly going to Ahrar al-Sham, which they're a pretty harsh Islamist group. But the point is that, as you well know, money and weapons are fungible, especially in a battle zone like this. And as we're going to talk about later with Lande, the so-called moderates of the Free Syrian Army, they're a hell of a lot closer to the al-Nusra Front than they are to us. They need them. And if the al-Nusra Front needs weapons from them, they get them. And I don't know if anybody has the actual, like, you know, real connect the dots in a very tight way, let me know. I can only loosely connect them and give it like sure seems like. And a speculation, not an absolute fact, but it sure looks to me like it was American trucks, or, you know, the Toyota trucks came from American transfers to the Free Syrian Army. I mean, they had whole warehouses full of stuff that got sacked last December. But there were reports in foreignpolicy.com and Public Radio International from the spring of this year before the fall of Mosul about a transfer of a bunch of trucks, dozens anyway, to the Free Syrian Army. And then these, I believe, were the very same trucks that were used for the reinvasion of Iraq by the Islamic State when they headed from Syria across the border and then straight to Mosul in June. Call it backdraft. Blowing up right in your face, you know? These things happen. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. And, yeah, well, anyway. It's actually kind of a fun time, in a sense. I mean, it's absolutely horrible the way there's a new war starting and everything. I don't mean that. But the contradictions in the policy, I don't think have ever been more stark for anyone, right? You know, Dave driving down the highway in his truck right now, like everyone knows. Hey, wait a minute. We're backing the rebels against Assad, the evil tyrant. Now we're pretending to, I'm not talking about the evil tyrant at all anymore, but we're attacking the rebels and question mark conceding that they really were Al-Qaeda suicide bombers all along, because that's who they are. They're the bad guys from the Iraq War. Well, America's enemies from the Iraq War. And yeah, the bad guys. The sons of Zarqawi. The madmen, suicide bombers of women and children who played their role perfectly in fighting the Sunni side of the sectarian war that George W. Bush got started over there. And yeah, they're really bad guys. As Lande points out, I'm sorry, I'm like kind of ruining the whole Lande interview coming up in a while, but as Lande points out in his article, and the reason I know this is because I was reading it in McClatchy, David Enders reporting from back then, especially, that the United States, they admitted, I guess somebody at the State Department went ahead and classified the al-Nusra Front as nothing but al-Qaeda in Iraq and put them on the terrorist list. And reported it to the media that, hey, these al-Nusra guys are bad guys. Yeah, well, guess what? It's been their war this whole time. I'm like, God, it's like talking about Iran's nuclear program on the world's worst broken record in the whole world on this stuff. Say it over and over again. The moderates don't fight. The money and the guns have gone to al-Nusra. It's their war. It's been their war. And then ISIS split off from the al-Nusra Front. I guess I don't talk about this enough. People need to understand this. I don't know. I mean, if you want. There's a faction fight inside al-Qaeda is what happened. Because this guy, Baghdadi, wanted to be the chief and declare a caliphate. And Ayman al-Zawahiri told him, no, go back to Iraq and fight in Iraq and leave the al-Nusra Front, the war in Syria. And I guess partly because you know, Baghdadi's guys were more violent. The Iraqis were had different tactics, even more brutal tactics than the al-Nusra prisoner beheader suicide bombers already are. Who their Nusra is just, you know, al-Qaeda. The guy's still loyal to Zawahiri. And then, so when Zawahiri told Baghdadi, go back to Iraq, Baghdadi said, what's Iraq? Why, I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about, old man, hiding like a coward in a basement in Pakistan in charge of nothing. Watch me. And he went and declared a new caliphate. Well, I mean, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. But he refused to follow Zarqawi's orders, Zawahiri's orders, and go back to Iraq. He stayed in Syria for another few months, and then he went back into Iraq on his own time and declared that such a thing didn't exist anymore. And had the captured bulldozers destroy the berm border between Syria and Iraq and erase the pseudo Sykes-Picot line. Because it wasn't really the Sykes-Picot line, it was different. But anyway, the pseudo Sykes-Picot line, they literally erased it, at least in some places. and combined eastern Syria with western Iraq into a new Sunnistan, so-called Islamic State. And meanwhile, the leader of the al-Nusra Front in Syria stayed loyal to Zawahiri. His name is Golani. And I guess him and Baghdadi, why, they don't get along so well. And Baghdadi decided, who needs you? And so, where the al-Nusra Front has kept fighting the Syrian government, ISIS has basically just come in and, scooped up sovereignty over all the land that al-Nusra has taken from the state. Focused their attentions elsewhere, basically easy targets, like Fallujah and Mosul and Bakuba and Samarra. Well, I don't know so much Samarra, but the predominantly Sunni parts of Iraq, where they knew they could just basically march right in, which is exactly what they did. Drove in their fancy new pickup trucks. And so, the thing of it is they've been lying their asses off to you, right? They've been lying their asses off to everybody, and they've been omitting the truth, which is a damn lie. And so people are starving for context here. Maybe I ain't the very best one to explain it, but it's not like the CIA and the Israelis created these men in a laboratory and then, parachuted them in or something like that. It's Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who it is. Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And by the way, in case you're young or in case you're formerly a conservative or in case you just don't know, in case you never were interested then but you'd like to know now, there never was Al-Qaeda. Not one member ever. Zero. In Iraq. Before the invasion of 2003. Colin Powell lied when he pretended that Zarqawi was tied to Saddam, was tied to Osama. He was neither. He had told Osama, no, I don't want to work with you. I got my own thing going on against the King of Jordan is my focus. And Saddam Hussein had told his Mukhbarat, find this guy and kill him. And meanwhile, the neocons, Ahmed Chalabi in the Weekly Standard told you that Saddam had operated on Zarqawi and given him a wooden leg and all this crap just to pretend that they were tied together and it wasn't true. That was the supposed one example they could come up with of Saddam and Osama. And it was a guy who was the enemy of one and the scorned would-be partner of the other. And anyway, after the Americans invaded, and after they turned it into a sectarian war with their occupation and with their hiring of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigades to be the new army and all this stuff, Zarqawi, after the insurgency had been around for a while, the insurgency really got going in the summer of 2003 after just a couple of months, but it still took more than a year and a half. It wasn't until the end of 2004, the very end of 2004, that Zarqawi declared his loyalty to bin Laden and renamed his group from Ansar al-Islam into Al-Qaeda in Iraq or Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. And then they were the most violent of, not just the most violent, but the most tactically savage of the Sunni-based insurgency, deliberately targeting Shia civilians in order to provoke the Shia militias into cracking down on the Sunnis so that the Sunnis would then need them more. For protection, etc. That's how terrorism works. Only, it really didn't work out so well because I guess Zarqawi was no good at math, and what he ended up doing was losing all of Baghdad for the Sunni, basically. It was going to happen anyway. Because Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney had hired the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Badr Brigade, who worked for Iran, and their entire goal all along was to take Baghdad and to kick all the Sunnis out. So, there were plenty of sides in that sectarian war. Again, it was the Americans were the most responsible for it all. But then Zarqawi was killed in 2006. And the local tribes marginalized these guys for a while. But then Obama started backing them in Syria in 2011. They rose back up again from the muck. And now here we are. Blew up in everybody's face bigger than they could have imagined. Except me and Patrick Coburn,
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Yeah, sorry. No more typing. Now radioing. Hey, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Wait, one more thing to type. Oops, I typed it in the wrong place. All right. Yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, jeez. I'm distracted. I spent my whole break doing anything but preparing for this segment. There's so much news, though. Coming up on the show, Jonathan Landay to talk about these insane things going on over there. I'm going to mention again this scoop. If you didn't see it, Mitchell Prothero sources U.S. airstrikes in Syria targeted French agent who defected to Al-Qaeda. Woo, Mitchell Prothero. He'll be on the show tomorrow to talk about that. Ain't that something? And then, yeah, there's the Biden thing. Talked about that. This Hannah Long piece I never got to read. And I'm trying to get Jeff Stein on the show, although I haven't even had a chance to read this dang thing yet. I mentioned it to you Friday. You may have heard me. Jeff Stein, investigative reporter from over there at Newsweek nowadays. He kind of bounces around. He's got this story about the CIA working with Hezbollah to fight ISIS. Oh, I don't know. I guess probably they have to compromise with them in some ways. For several years now, there's been an unwritten, unacknowledged ceasefire between the combatants. They know where we are and could easily take out our officers, a senior CIA official told Newsweek last year on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive U.S.-Hezbollah relations. But they haven't. Not that they have acquiesced to CIA operations in Beirut. In 2011, for example, Hezbollah merely exposed the names and faces of some alleged CIA officers in Lebanon rather than killing them. Such restraint reflects Hezbollah's transformation from a Shiite movement and welfare service with an armed militia and terrorist arm to a powerful political force. The Party of God and its allies now hold more than a third of the cabinet portfolios in Lebanon's coalition government and 12 seats in the parliament. And that alone gives Hezbollah virtual veto over CIA operations in Lebanon, if not making them de facto partners against ISIS, whose aim is to liquidate the forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah's longtime protector. "The enemy of my enemy is a worse enemy," quipped Ali Soufan, a former top FBI counterterrorism official, speaking of the joint interests of Shiite Hezbollah and Iran and the U.S. to degrade and destroy, as Obama put it, the Sunni Islamic State. You know, this reminds me of something else that is annoying the hell out of me lately. Some of my favorite writers are so tempted. Everyone is so tempted to end their article with, "Well, I got an idea what you could do." Oh, come off it. How about stop killing people? How about that? How about don't ally with ISIS against Assad? And don't ally with Hezbollah and Assad against ISIS either. What about that? Is it impossible for people to think of this stuff on their own or what? I gotta write it down for you and mail it to you? Hey, what if instead of picking which group of terrorists to arm, we just stopped maybe? What about if you think about that for just a moment? Could we do that? Could we think about that? Now I expect this out of the damn Democrats, although I want to kick them really hard about it. But they're the Democrats. You can expect the very worst from them. But I'm talking about some of my favorite writers are ending their essays, and you know what it is. You know what's their recommendation. "We've got to ally with Russia and Syria and Iran against the Islamic State." Face it. No, I don't want to face it. We shouldn't have allied with the Iraqi Shia and the Iranians in conquering Baghdad 2003 through 2011.
And we shouldn't go to help them fight over the consequences of that same failed policy right now. If we help them win, then what? We're going to have to continue to help them occupy all those cities. I mean, it's impossible anyway that the so-called Iraqi army is going to take over these majority Sunni cities. But even if they did, then what? Then America is again, just like George W. Bush's era in power, serving as the sock puppet army of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, I don't really care about that so much as though I have a particular beef with Iran, because my point about Iran overall is that you notice that they've never done anything to us other than overthrow America's sock puppet dictator. And then, you know, it was a riot that seized the hostages, and yeah, they should have let them go earlier, but they made a deal with the Republicans to hold on to the hostages longer to make Jimmy Carter look bad so that Ronald Reagan could win. So, you know. But all they ever really did was overthrow the Shah, and they had the right to do that. They declared independence from the American Empire, and they had the right to do that, even under the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was a horrible tyrant, and his successor ain't too much better if you live there, I'm sure. But regardless, they're not really an enemy of the United States. The worst thing they ever did was trick George Bush into fighting an 8-year war for them. Well, tough. That's America's fault for being stupid. And being taken advantage of, shame on you for being taken advantage of by the Ayatollah Khomeini when anybody could see what he was doing. Hell, Iraqi National Congress headquarters was in Tehran. Huh, I wonder if maybe Chalabi's got their interests in mind. Nah, it couldn't be that. Crying out loud. But here we are. Really good writers, anti-war writers, people who they gotta know better, are saying we should ally with Assad, we should ally with Iran against ISIS. No. How about just not? How about recommending an end to all the kinetic activity, as they call mass murdering people nowadays? Oh, George Carlin, I miss you. Kinetic activity. Yeah, how about just stop? In fact, here's the thing about it. Never mind libertarianism. Never mind simple human decency or common sense. How about just from a pure common sense, utilitarian point of view. Never mind decency or principle at all. But just from a utilitarian point of view, obviously the best way to defeat ISIS is to let them burn themselves out and let them be overthrown by the people who they have attempted to foist their rule onto. Now, possibly there will be a big fight over Kirkuk, but I think the Peshmerga can hold them. Probably. The Shiites can certainly hold Baghdad. There's no question about that. And Assad can hold Damascus. The Jordanian army, according to Eric Margulies, he says the Jordanian army could kick ISIS's ass. They're not crossing into Jordan. They're not crossing into Jordan. They are well-armed and well-trained. They're not like the Saudi military that exists only to pay American welfare dollars to Lockheed. They are a real-ass killer military. They are safe from IS in Jordan. And then they ain't walking as far as Cairo or Riyadh, so forget that. So that's it. They're completely landlocked. They're completely surrounded by enemies. The Shiites, the Shiite Arab Iraqis, the Iranians, and that includes, their militias and so-called army, the Iranians who back them, the Kurds, the Turks, which the Turks, I guess, are probably at least want to keep them out of Turkey, right? I wonder if Erdogan is going to let ISIS invade Turkish Kurdistan to keep killing the PKK. There's an interesting question. Assume that America could strike a deal with Erdogan where he keeps them out of Turkey. They'll burn themselves out trying to rule the Sunnis of Iraq and Syria because everyone hates them because, guess what, Al-Qaeda are jerks. They murder civilians and they're terrible. Nobody wants them around.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket-sized print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. All right, sorry, no more typing during the damn show. Later on, Jonathan Landay, one of the best war reporters, national security beat reporters in America, is going to be on the show to tell us some things about the new war. I got to figure out what I'm calling this thing. I don't know. Is there an official thing? Like whether Al-Qaeda has an E or an I. Is it Iraq War 3? But it includes Syria too, so is it the war on the Islamic State? Terror war part 10 million? The mass slaughter that Obama's doing right now. It needs an official title. The mass slaughter. We're going to get back to all that in just a minute, but I want to go ahead and take this segment to talk about the war at home. It's really important, this war at home that we've got. You know, it's funny. I don't know if I've ever told this on the radio, but when I was, 1994 or something like that, so however old I was in, I guess 17, 18. No, it would have been earlier than that. Maybe 91 or 92 or something. I was down on the drag, which is Guadalupe Street down by UT here in Austin. And some guy gave me a flyer that was a bunch of stormtroopers of death with black helicopters around them and everything. And it was really badly copied so that, like, everything on it was black. You know what I mean? Where you just barely differentiate the mass of people being squished and all the different things going on. And it said, fight back while you still can. I really took that to heart. Now that I think about it, I think that thing really brainwashed the hell out of me. I think I hung it up on the wall in my room and I kind of looked at it a lot. Fight back while you still can. Because if you let things slip too far, then it's going to be really dangerous to even stick your neck out whatsoever. To even raise your hand in protest at all. And we all want to live long and die old, right? So fight back now while there's still a semblance of maybe we could if we try hard. And now here I am. It's the future. and all that fighting back didn't really happen so much. I mean, I tried my best, but my best sure wasn't enough to make the difference, that's for sure. And now here we are where... And maybe it was always this way. If you're, as long as you're, you know, in a minority group in America, then you probably always saw it this way. But I think it's becoming more and more clear to everyone now that there's really no such thing as law at all. That, like, among some lawyers and judges and government people, a very small percentage of them may have some, like, real ideal that they really believe in about law being the best way to protect humanity from all the terrible consequences of humanity and stuff. Believe in it as a thing and really care about it and stuff. But for the most part, no. Not as it's really exercised. Really, law is just an excuse for government to wage war against the people that it supposedly exists to protect. That's it. They're just constantly at war against us. And they pretend that, hey, the president, on down, the police officer, the local sheriff, and the FBI agents, and the CIA even, everybody, we're all just citizens. None of us have special rights. A license to kill, like on James Bond, no, that's just fiction. Because no one has the right to murder anyone. So you couldn't license. The government doesn't have the authority. They don't have the authority then to license anyone else to be their agent with a right to kill people. You have the right to defend yourself. Including, up to and including, using deadly force in proportion, or to defend another innocent life. But that's no more right than any other human being has. Right? The theory is that they're just citizens like us, that the law applies to them like us, and yet we all know that it's a joke. That in fact, the lowest rookie deputy sheriff at the poorest poorest county anywhere in America has as much rights as an American billionaire from New York City. as much rights as a movie star going into court. Whereas the rest of us are lower than dogs. And they can do whatever they want with us. And I know it sounds like an extreme thing or whatever if you're not used to hearing people talk like this. But just look. The cop that shot Aisha Jones in the SWAT raid at her house in Detroit. Well, it's been a couple of years. You may have forgotten, at least your emotions are over it now, right? And so the judge has thrown out the manslaughter charge against the cop. He kicked in the door. There's a 7-year-old girl sleeping on the couch. She sat up on the couch. He put a bullet between her eyes. Which, of course, means blew the back of her head all over the wall, right? Destroyed this little girl with his German MP5 machine gun. And the law doesn't apply to him. He's been on paid vacation this whole time. He's got better union rules than any group of gangsters in America, as we all know. And now they're whittling it down to, I don't know, what's, you know, man 9 or whatever. What's the very least bit? They're going to call it, what, a non-aggravated assault and battery charge maybe now? Or are they just going to drop the charges entirely now? For a cop that shot a 7-year-old girl in the head in her own living room when he was breaking and entering. With, you know, in conspiracy with the local court, which gave him supposedly the license to break and enter this house in the middle of the night, pointing his machine gun at whoever happened to be in front of him. Charges dismissed. And now here's one. Chances are there will be no charges here at all. 99% chance. Cops killed Georgia grandpa in no-knock raid triggered by burglary suspect's tip. The guy's burgled. The cops catch the burglar. The burglar says, oh, when I robbed him, he had all these drugs. Let me go. He's the guy you want. So they made the deal with him. And they went and did a SWAT raid in the middle of the night, 11 o'clock at night, which is the middle of the night for a grandfather. The wife sees the men outside, wakes him up, or you know, gets him from his room, wherever he was. He grabs his shotgun. They think they're being robbed again. They think it's the same robbers have now come back for them. He opens the door. They blow him away. Now, I bet you $1,000 that he was not pointing his shotgun directly in their face. What do you bet? And even then, all they had to do was say, police, 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 as they entered the property, right? But they didn't do that. They went creeping around like, oh, no, because Nelson Rockefeller says you gotta flush your drugs down the toilet. So we don't have to identify ourselves. We just come kicking in the door like the Waco raid on a daily basis in America now. Kill first, shrug later. No questions. Innocent man. Oh, and where's all the meth, guys? No meth. No, the actual criminal was the one who was the criminal. Guess what? Huh. Murder. And will any of these cops be held accountable for this at all? No, you know that they will not. You know that they will not be held accountable at all. Paid vacation is the worst thing that will ever happen to a murderer cop in America because there's no law. There's just a gang of thugs who call themselves the state who claim, in the most ridiculous fashion, to be our security force when they're just predators. That's all they are. Here they are retaliating. This is at libertycrier.com. Police departments retaliate against organized cop watch groups across the U.S., right, because what right do Americans have to peacefully assemble, to petition their government for a redress of grievances, to participate in journalism, in democracy, that they might better protect their liberties and security? Whoever heard of any of that? Cop block? Let me tell you something. The cops created you. And they'll destroy you if they feel like it, right? Like that Bill Cosby thing about his wife, only not funny. they'll kill you if they feel like it. And if you want to organize a group of people called, hey, let's organize and watch these cops and what they're doing and try to see if we can figure out a way in our free and open democratic society to hold them accountable, they're coming for your ass next. Because we're in the future. Because you didn't fight back when you still could. And you're living in the homeland now. The USA is dead and buried. And you have no rights that they are bound to respect. That's the truth. Ask this guy, U.S. Army veteran went and killed people fighting for our freedom. I mean, fighting for the government in the name of the country. Kenneth Williams sat in jail for a year and drugged on mistaken identity down in Georgia. Why was he drugged, Scott? Because he told them, I'm not the guy you're looking for. You've got the wrong guy. You've got the wrong guy. And they said, Judge, he won't even admit he's the guy. Let us drug him. And they kidnapped him and kept him for a year. And there will be no accountability because there's no law. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. I'm Scott. Hey, listen, if you believe this, then you have to believe that, too. Or else what's wrong with you? Because that's the thing that we all believe, right? You don't believe the thing we all believe? Huh. That can't be right. Something's probably wrong with you. The CIA got to you, or they're paying you, or you're just too afraid that people won't like you anymore. You got to be brave enough to ask the real questions. Couldn't possibly be that you're just right. Nope. I don't believe it. Alright, well, anyway, I'm Scott. This is my show. I don't like your evidence if it doesn't confirm my bias, so screw you. In fact, I don't even see what relevance your evidence has if it doesn't confirm my bias. How do you like that? That's called logic. I learned that on the internet. All right, coming up on the show, Jonathan Landay is going to be here to talk about Iraq War 3. So that's going to be good. Lots to talk about there with the great Jonathan Landay. Right now, let me talk about North Korea for a little bit. The DPRK, as they like to call themselves, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So Kim Jong-un, that is Dictator the Third here, why, he's just gone. They say he's got the gout. And he's on an extended medical leave. And supposedly his sister is now running things. And then, blam, all of a sudden they sent people to go and meet and shake hands and do this photo op with the South Korean reunification minister. And to plan further talks in a short amount of time. Boy, they better hurry. I think they said they wanted to do it within the month. I'm not sure. There may be an update, guys, about whether they had set a date or not. But they better hurry, because the Americans will do everything they can to prevent the reunification of the Korean Peninsula. Can you imagine? South Korea's economy with North Korea's low wages and nuclear weapons. Boy, could they be an independent power that America would have to deal with. Whereas right now, one's a helpless enemy and the other a loyal sock puppet. Who wants to screw that up? Well, apparently the North does. Makes me wonder, does it make you wonder? Nah, I guess this is stupid. But I don't know, what do I know? Maybe it's the sisters saying, hey, I've always wanted to do this and now's my chance and nobody can stop me because what are you going to do? And I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. Maybe there's been a coup d'etat. I've seen some speculation there's been a coup d'etat. Maybe the kid's just got the gout. Maybe he never really wanted to be dictator in the first place. I guess I'm learning that the North Koreans take the feminist part of Marxism very seriously, huh? I didn't realize that women could be so powerful in the North Korean communist dictatorship. But I guess I really don't know that much about North Korea. But yeah, so there you go. Now, you might remember, I can give you a little bit of background on this, that they had a thing, the sunshine policy. Remember that? Sunshine. Oh, it's warm and it's pretty and I like it, right? Yeah, sunshine. We all like sunshine. And they were getting along and they had built an office park on the North Korean side of the border where the South Koreans would go to work every day. And they were having more and more of these exchanges where family members were able to meet either at the DMZ or the North Koreans were able to go to South Korea for a while and come back or vice versa. And this kind of thing was happening. And then George W. Bush ruined it. And he ruined it for the reasons I just said. They don't want a reunified peninsula that could be, at least soon enough, more powerful and more independent than the cornered and helpless North Korea now and the loyal, independent South Korea that we still occupy with 30,000-something troops, like 35,000 troops. And so what happened was the Republicans came in the Bush Jr. years, and they came up with all these stories, and they basically just lied us out of the agreement that we had. Bill Clinton had sent William Perry back in 1994. Wait, was it Perry? I think it was Perry. No, it was Warren Christopher, right? Yeah, he sent Warren Christopher over there, and he made the deal, and it was called the Agreed Framework. And what it said was, we'll give you money, and we'll give you fuel oil, and we will give you a light water reactor, which is much harder to get weapons-grade plutonium out of, if you will promise to leave off your Soviet-era very weapons-grade plutonium-producing reactor at Pyongyang, and... I thought I heard the music playing. Jeez. Boy, am I talking that slow? So they had this great deal. Bill Clinton had made this deal, which, you know what, I'm not for paying welfare to North Korea or to anyone, really, but all things considered, this was the most libertarian solution. And really, it was fine, and even though Clinton never lived up to his end of the deal, I mean, he paid his welfare to Donald Rumsfeld's company for the light water reactor, but I don't think they ever, I'm pretty certain they did not ever go there and build it. And yeah, it was Rumsfeld's company that got the contract to do it. And they never lived up to their end of the deal, but then they accused the North Koreans of breaching their end of the deal, and they accused a North Korean diplomat of admitting, apropos of nothing, at a cocktail party, that, oh yeah, we have had a secret uranium enrichment program this whole time that we haven't told anyone about until me telling you drunkenly now or something, supposedly was the story. Even though there's no real reason to believe that whatsoever, it seemed entirely made up. And even though we know they have a uranium enrichment program now, there's no reason to believe they had it back in the fall of 2002 when the State Department under John Bolton and Colin Powell came up with this crap. And I think Colin Powell didn't want it this way. It was Bolton and Wurmser working for Cheney. In that separate government that Powell was always ranting about, that did this. And anyway, and then they came up with something called the Proliferation Security Initiative, which was completely outside the UN or the Nuclear Suppliers Group or anything else. It was a new unilateral claim on the power to interdict any North Korean boat on the high seas in order to make sure that they're not proliferating weapons, mass destruction, etc., like that. And then they also added on a whole new round of sanctions. And Bush repeatedly insulted Kim Jong-il and said that the agreed framework is off. And even though we've never lived up to our end of the deal, maybe they gave him a little bit of money and fuel oil at one or two points, but they basically had never lived up to the deal. Even then they said, well, the deal is off because you've broken it now, which was a lie. But anyway, and only after months and months of this, and then finally the sanctions, only in the spring, right around, and you're distracted with the start of the Iraq War, the second one. But in the spring of 2003, the North Koreans finally said, fine then. And then they withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kicked the IAEA inspectors out of the country, and began making nuclear weapons. They had a deal. And now they're in a much stronger position, of course, and they're holding the estimates, the popular estimates among the non-proliferator types is half a dozen to a dozen plutonium implosion bombs, although I think all three of their tests have been somewhat failures. It's very difficult to do the implosion systems, you see. The South Korean president Ro, back in 2006 or 2007, he wanted to go ahead, and he committed suicide later. He wanted to pick back up the reunification process and the Sunshine Policy, and George Bush just refused to let him. In fact, there was a joint press conference where Bush said, once the North Koreans do everything we want on the nuclear issue, even though he had just pushed them to make nukes in the first place, only then can we talk about reunification. And Ro said, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Translator. Did I just misunderstand the president? Mr. President, did you just say that we can work on the nuclear issue and reunification at the same time? And Bush said, no, I did not say that. What I said was we can never talk about reunification again until the nuclear issue is put to bed. She was the one who just made it a damned issue. And, of course, it remains unresolved. And at the very least, you say they've tested three and are likely to do better the fourth time. But anyway, this is good news. And thank God George Bush is far from power now, can't call these shots anymore. Obama might find a way to screw it up still. Hey, I'll Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. So, a couple things to cover here. Money for warmongers is one of them. William Hartung at the Huffington Post with Stephen Miles. Who will profit from the wars in Iraq and Syria? Lockheed. Lockheed. More than anyone else. Now, Kellogg Brown and Root, Halliburton, all them, they might do some work here with the Kurds, this kind of thing. And I guess before too long, there will be enough ground troops, so maybe Halliburton can get back to building some bases there. Refurbishing some of the bases they already have in Kurdistan, that kind of thing. But for now, it's all about Raytheon cruise missiles and Boeing JDAM bombs and Lockheed Martin planes and missiles. And they love it. I've been kicking myself because when Tom Woods interviewed me and said, you know, okay, so if the war's a disaster, if it can't work, and everybody already knows it going in, then what's it really all about? I gave him a smart-ass answer, which is correct, about how, well, geez, I don't know, Tom, because all the politics are for continuing to back these guys against Assad because America's capital city is run by the government of Israel. And they hate Iran more. And therefore hate Syria and Hezbollah more. And then I said, well, I guess it just comes down to it looks really bad for Osama bin Laden incarnate, basically, this guy Baghdadi, bin Laden only with a real religious degree, has declared himself the caliph out of Raqqa and Mosul. And they just can't have that. Just for PR reasons. How can Obama be the president that sat around when you know, a guy who might as well be bin Laden's twin brother came to power and declared himself the caliph? Can't go down in history that way. He's got to do something. So his policy has been a more anti-Shiite policy lately. Now he's got to switch back to them, or at least, you know, crack down on the Sunnis again, too. But I should have also said, and Tom, it's always the banks and the arms manufacturers. I mean, I'm no good at math at all. Maybe you're the kind of people who can do all these decimal points in your head or whatever. But what's a few percentage service charge on a transfer of a couple of tens of billions of dollars from the U.S. Treasury to the bank account of a company like General Dynamics or Raytheon? It's a huge amount of money. And it's not just a couple of percentage points, right? It's probably more like 10. I'm just making stuff up. I don't know exactly. But the banks are always making a huge margin on any transfers of government wealth in these gigantic numbers to private actors on the level of Lockheed and Boeing, etc. And plus, of course, they get to make money just servicing the government's debt all the time. That's free money to them all the time. Every bond that they buy, they can turn around and loan out a bunch of money based on that bond. That's the scam of the Federal Reserve System. Read all about it. And so they're always for any deficit spending of any kind. The banks are always stand to gain. And no matter how bad their businesses are, they always stand to get bailed out, too. So they can take all that money and invest it in their friends and invest it in their cronies and invest it in whatever they want. And it doesn't even have to be a good business decision or even seem like one. So they're always in on it. But then, yeah, man, Lockheed, Lockheed, Lockheed. I'm going to tell you this 1,000 times more. How many of you guys have heard me say this a bunch of times and you still haven't read the damn thing? Lockheed stock and two smoking barrels. It's 7 years old now, but I don't care. It's by Richard Cummings. It ran at Playboy.com. Unfortunately, they didn't put it in the magazine, the cowards. And it's not even on their website anymore, but it is on my website, and it is at corpwatch.com. It's called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And it's about how every single brand name neocon that you know, and I don't mean at the Weekly Standard and National Review and the Washington Post, but I mean actually that were in power in the Bush administration. They were all Lockheed guys. Fife and Wolfowitz and, let's see, I don't know about Ludi. I think Ludi too, but then Wurmser and Bolton, John Hanna and Stephen Rohde and Stephen Hadley. Now Hadley didn't work directly for Lockheed, but he was a lawyer for the firm that represented Lockheed and worked on Lockheed cases there. And I'm leaving people out. John Hanna. The whole damn vice president's office. And the neocons of the Pentagon. Oh, did I not say Richard Pearl? Richard Pearl. And, you know, to hear Richard Cummings, and I interviewed him back in 07 about it, you can hear it. When I interviewed him, he, you know, his thesis is that these neocons love Lockheed more than Israel. And that's what they're really about, is getting Lockheed products sold. And that sure is a huge part of this. And it's just free money for them. They could set the margin at whatever they want. And the weapons don't even have to work as advertised either. If they miss, that's all right. Just that's more that they got to buy next time. Who cares? It's all close enough for government work. You know, you don't have to be an actual government employee. You just have to be a government contractor for those exact dynamics and incentives to come into play. When I was a kid, I was a surveyor, and we got work done. Unless it was a government job. Surveying for Texas Highway 130. Oh, no, sir. We're going to ride the clock or we're going to sit out at the picnic tables and eat our breakfast tacos. And we are going to take all the time in the world the firm wants us to drag this out as long as possible. Hey, it's government work. Same thing with the Lockheed guys. And I still think this is hilarious. The headline was written with such hyperbole. About something along the lines of, oh my effing God, can you believe that Lockheed spent $14 million on lobbying in the first quarter of, oh, I don't know, 2010 or 2012 or whatever it was. And I'm thinking $14 million on lobbying? And how many billions, how many tens of billions of dollars did they get back? Give me a break. It's the best business to be in the world if you don't mind killing people for profit. It's the best job as hitman you can get, and that is being on the board of directors or executive vice president or some kind of boss over at Lockheed. It's just free money all day. The people who own that stock and collect those dividend checks. And their planes suck. You're supposed to hit insurgents on the ground with AK-47s and win a war against them, flying at 50,000 feet at Mach 2. I mean, they're trying to outright cancel the A-10. Oh, they probably saved it. But it's the one Air Force weapon that's actually useful in these kind of engagements because they're tough and they can fly low and slow enough that they can see who they're killing and who they're protecting on the ground. And they're trying to get rid of that, completely cancel the A-10 just so they can give that job to the completely worthless F-35 that couldn't possibly do it without killing their own guys all the time. Because they'll have to do it at super high speeds from far away. What a joke. Oh, those Air Force guys having jobs, having to go and save the life of Army people on the ground. Gross. That's the way they think of it, right? All that inter-service nationalism that they got. The degradation of serving the army. So, anyway. If you have lots of money and you don't mind being soaked in blood, then invest now while the getting is good. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next, we got Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Boy, do we have a lot of important stuff to talk about. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Jonathan?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me back.
Very good to have you here. Very good to read your report. And here I found out the Modesto B. It's a constant struggle to get around the McClatchy paywall these days.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, whatever.
we got families to feed.
I understand. So there's, but here's the plot to get around it. Don't tell the bosses, Jonathan. I said so. There's the SAC B, and there's the Mod B, and there's the Miami Herald. Sometimes too, will let us look at your stuff. They all have paywalls too, but you have to. Ration out which websites you view,
right,
which Prothro and Landay articles at. But anyway, so here we go. Boots in the air. U.S. helicopters return to combat in Iraq for the first time. And, go ahead. Tell me a story.
Well, so it was my colleague in Erbil, in Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, Mitchell Prothero, who first noticed...
Oh, God, I've been saying his last name wrong this whole
time. No, you've
been
saying it right, actually. It's Prothero.
Oh, okay, I was going to say, because I've been calling he likes to be called Mitch, and I knew
I
screwed that up.
Well, that's the way we talk. That's what we call him.
All right.
Well, anyway,
Larissa still calls you Landy, so it's all right.
It's true. So he noticed that on this, the standard Central Command emailed press releases that we get every day, which is the only way we really find out, at least on a day-to-day basis, a modicum of what's going on in terms of the U.S. intervention in Iraq and Syria, that for the first time they mentioned that helicopter gunships had been used against the Islamic State in just outside of Baghdad. And it's the first time that Army helicopters have been used in this intervention. And it represents sort of a new phase in that before, the air campaign consisted of, what are referred to as fast movers, combat jets, bombers, and drones. And now you have these helicopters, which, troops refer to as flying low and slow, at least relative to the fast movers, which is a whole new level of risk in terms of what the Obama administration is prepared to allow U.S. troops there to do. But beyond that, it's also an indication that the airstrikes by the fast movers have not succeeded in preventing the Islamic State from massing and moving in offensive actions. And the fact that this is happening close to Baghdad was pretty significant. So that's what we wrote.
Yeah. Well, like you say, it goes to show that so far bombing them with F-18s, it hasn't stopped them from getting this far, if in fact that was part of it. I mean, I know that there was a siege of that military base, I think just on the other side of Abu Ghraib from Baghdad, that the base ended up falling. And the soldiers were ambushed and killed. Patrick Coburn wrote just, a week ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, was there American air power deployed?
I think you're talking
there?
About Camp Spiker. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm not certain which base it was. It didn't go by that name in the article I read. I can pull it up here probably. But, do you know, was there air power, American air power deployed there or only up in Kurdistan?
No, I mean, American air power has been deployed around Baghdad for some time now. because the Islamic State, you know, they've essentially overrun most of Anbar province now. And they and Mitch wrote last week about how they had actually moved into the verges of Baghdad's western suburbs. They've it appears that they've basically taken over the infamous town of Abu Ghraib, which is where the infamous prison is located, and are now kind of on the western edges of Baghdad. And that kind of puts them within shelling distance, or pretty close to Baghdad International Airport, which is where hundreds of American advisors, military advisors, are based. There's a joint operations center there where American and Iraqi officers work together to coordinate ground and air operations. And it's also kind of the way the United States would evacuate the largest embassy it has anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Which is why American troops, one of the places they were sent when President Obama decided to intervene, was Baghdad International Airport to increase the security there.
Well, and as you said, that's where these helicopters are stationed now, right? And
yes.
By the way, I pulled up the Cobra, and he says that Sokolawiya is the base. Is that the Spicer base, or do you know?
I have no idea.
Well, anyway, he says on the 21st of September, so it was a couple of weeks back, that it was completely overrun. And I knew that there had been some strikes near Baghdad, but I wasn't sure if that was an ongoing thing or it doesn't seem like flying F-18s around is going to prevent the Islamic State fighters from traveling from, you know, Fallujah to the outskirts of Baghdad. There are still Sunni neighborhoods in southwest Baghdad for them to be based out of, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But we knew this right from the beginning. I mean, even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has acknowledged that you can't really deal with these guys without a ground force. And at the moment, at least in Iraq, that ground force is the Iraqi army, and in some circumstances it's been Shiite militias. And in Syria, of course, there really isn't one, and that's something that the Obama administration is trying to rectify by with this plan of theirs to train and arm a Syrian opposition force, moderate, vetted Syrian opposition force, but we're quite a ways away from that.
Well, and I want to get back to that because you got
to. But on the Iraqi side of things, I mean, the fact is that, the Iraqi army all but collapsed when the Islamic State launched its offensive in mid-June. You had at least four divisions just basically disintegrate. They're trying to rebuild it. That's part of the American plan, is trying to sort of rebuild the broken Iraqi army, which was, you know, infected with nepotism and corruption and bad officers. And so that's going on. And it's not, you know, it's not a force that is fully capable of being able to defend its own country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole thing of it is. It seems to me like that's not really right, but depending on how you define their own country, they can defend Baghdad because
that's
their land.
Well, we have to wait and see, Scott. We're not sure. I mean, you know, they haven't been able to stop the car bombings. You know, we had in the lead up to the offensive in June by the Islamic State, which went first at Mosul, there was an increase, something like, I'm probably going to get my dates wrong, but between 2000 and 12 in 2013, it went from something like 10 to 15 car bombs a week to over 50. I mean,
yeah, but that was in Sunni stand. That's now declared independence.
No, it was happening in Baghdad.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, but still,
no,
keeping out suicide bombers isn't. That's
right.
Still.
Right, and these guys have now. They're all the way in the southern. I mean, they're all the way south of Baghdad. You know, close to several of the Shiite religious, the holiest towns in Shiism, Najaf and Karbala, and the Iraqi army has been unable to deal with it.
Yeah, well, but that's because really the militias, though, the Bada Brigade and the part of the Bada Brigade that's not AKA the Iraqi army and the Sadrs, they haven't really gone to war for Baghdad. I mean, it's not like there's an invasion for them to repel yet, but it's their city now because Bush gave it to them. So I don't know how they could possibly lose it with an 85% supermajority in the city now, but the damn music's playing and we got to take this break. But when we get back, we'll talk more with Jonathan Lande about the Iraq and Syria war here.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. Sorry, I meant to take that deep breath before I hit the button, not after, but well, these things happen. I'm talking with Jonathan S. Lande. He warned you about the neocons lining into war back in 02 and 03, and 01 and 02 and 03. And he's reporting now for McClatchy Newspapers at McClatchyDC.com. And so where we left off, we're talking about just how much relative strength the so-called Iraqi army and the Shiite militias have as compared to the Islamic State in Baghdad. And I guess you're right. I mean, we still don't really know if ISIS and say, Sadr's group go, you know, head-to-head in battle or even low-level warfare over a few months exactly how that's going to shape out. But it sure sounds like we agree that the Shiite militias and the Iraqi army are in no position whatsoever and maybe will never be in a position to take, quote-unquote, back the cities of Mosul and Fallujah and Tikrit and Bakuba and these other supermajority Sunni cities. That's just basically a pipe dream, that there's ever going to be a so-called central government in Baghdad ruling over a state of Iraq again.
Yeah, I mean, we're just going to have to wait and see, but there's very little prospect of that at the moment. And again, I know we keep talking about how Baghdad is the supermajority Shiite city now, but, you know, it doesn't take a lot to panic a city. It doesn't take a lot of violence, and you have this group that is absolutely feared and that has terrorized the areas that it has taken over. It's proven to be much more proficient at urban combat than the Iraqi army, and, you know, we can write off that they're going to conquer Baghdad, but to sow panic and terror and shut down the city and take neighborhoods, I wouldn't put that out of the realm of a very good possibility.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to being mean, he's got the Islamic State guy's got nothing on the Sadrists or the Bada Brigade, torturer, murderers, but except maybe artillery.
I mean, they've all done it. I mean, they all do it.
Yeah.
They're all as bad as each other.
Yeah, yeah, they certainly are. So when it comes to, you know, the willingness to fight ruthlessly and that kind of thing, it seems about an even match. But it may come down to just who has more American artillery to shoot at each other on the different sides here.
Crazy. Right. I mean, but again, when you have a built-up place like Baghdad, and you're in fierce urban street fights, artillery's not going to do a hell of a lot of good for you.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking more about what you were talking about, just sowing panic and chaos in the
capital
city.
I mean,
that was what Mitch said, was they could just shell Baghdad from 30 miles away.
That's
right. Shell them all damn day.
That's right.
And, you know, just
kind
of that
way. Although I actually don't see them actually being able to do that, because I got to say, the one thing that the United States air power can do is take those kinds of things out and take out heavy artillery. That's not something that the Islamic State is going to be able to keep sacrosanct from airstrikes.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's switch back to Syria here. I was trying to get you on last week, but you're busy. But this piece here from the second, U.S. and anti-Assad rebels in Syria remain at odds over the role of al-Qaeda's Nusra Front. And there's just so many contradictions and ironies and conflicts
and interests
and things in here. It's just absolutely incredible. Can you take us through it?
Well, sure. I mean, we know that in the first round of airstrikes that the United States staged in Syria, one of their targets was Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, which is the official al-Qaeda syndicate in Syria. And this did not sit well with the non-Islamic State rebel groups, because they work very closely with the Nusra Front. The Nusra Front is probably the most effective rebel fighting force next to the Islamic State. And here the United States was attacking a force that other Syrian rebels fighting the Assad regime are very much aligned with. And so there were protests, actually, in some of the Nusra Front-held areas, as well as other areas, against the United States targeting Nusra.
Right, and it seemed like pretty big and popular protests, too. That and really, isn't it the case, Jonathan, that the al-Nusra Front has always been the vanguard, and not just in doing the actual fighting, but in numbers, too, in this rebellion in Syria for the last 3 years?
I wouldn't say for 3 years, Scott. I mean, they really didn't show up until the year two of the civil war in any major way. And let's not forget, if they were sent there by Mr. Baghdadi, who's the head of the Islamic State. They were one and the same once upon a time. Yeah. And yes, I mean, next to the Islamic State, they are the most combat proficient rebel group fighting in Syria. You know, I actually spent a little time in their territory next to in one of the Baghdad suburbs, one of the Damascus suburbs last time I was there back in May. I was doing a piece on efforts to stamp out this return of polio. And the only area in which Nusra and the regime are cooperating is allowing the Red Crescent into besieged suburbs or besieged areas held by the opposition to inoculate children. And so I was actually allowed, the Nusra actually allowed me to go in to one of the suburbs of Damascus that they hold to watch a immunization program and take pictures. And it just shows you kind of, you know, the sophistication of this group. They knew I was an American, but they also wanted to try and sort of put out this, the idea that they recognize humanitarian needs, and particularly when it comes to children. The irony, of course, being that on the other hand, of course, you know, they stage car bombings and kill kids. And the regime, you know, fires barrel bombs and kills kids. So it's kind of ironic that these two groups are cooperating and trying to, you know, inoculate children against polio, and at the same time are killing children.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a public relations thing more than anyone else. I mean, these are warring armies after all. But, the Nusra guys, they actually kidnapped our friend David Enders and then let him go after 2 weeks.
Indeed.
Back last year, which is just, man, thank goodness for that he's safe. That's amazing.
Yeah.
This is the big contradiction, is trying to turn the policy around, and they can't quite turn it around back to Assad like Bill Clinton and George W. Bush used to work with Assad against the Mujahideen. They're trying to forge this third way now. And everybody agrees that this is a pipe dream too, right? They're going to train up 5,000 new non-extremist Mujahideen in Saudi for a year, and then they're going to send them back, and these 5,000 guys are going to take on Nusra, ISIS, and Assad and Hezbollah too on the other
side. Yeah, it sounds kind of pie in the sky, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I wonder how serious they are about this.
Well, I think they're serious. I mean, you know, the CIA is working with groups, certain groups in both the north and the south of Syria. I think they know people they can trust in terms of that effort. But, you know, a lot can happen in a year. And a lot can change in a year. And so we'll have to wait and see. But there are so many unaddressed details and unknowns that this program is going to have to that this effort faces, that it's hard to imagine that, in a year from now, it's going to go the way the administration envisions it. You know, the enemy gets a vote. Don't
right.
forget, the enemy gets to decide, you know, how it's going to react to the American plans. And as people in the military like to say, you know, a plan generally doesn't survive the first contact with the enemy.
Right.
So we'll have to wait and see. But, yeah, I mean, as I said, a lot can happen in a year, and I'm just not sure what they think they can accomplish with this in a year's time.
Yeah. Well, you know, over there in the chat room, they're talking about all the members of the coalition now, how they all have all their own motives. We can see right now where the Turks, even though their parliament declared war, gave Erdogan the authority, they're just sitting there and letting ISIS wipe out the PKK commie rebels
well,
that they already
hate. That's right. That's right.
So never mind the enemy. These are our best friends here.
Except, you know, I wouldn't doubt that if the Turks can, you know, if they succeed in by not intervening in Kobane, really hurting the PKK, then going in themselves and taking over that, you know, and establishing a PKK-free zone on their border.
Oh, good luck with that. That hadn't worked so well in the last 30 years.
Well, that's right.
All right. All right, we got to go. Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate it. Jonathan Landa,
everybody.
ClatchyDC.com. See you tomorrow.